Hey, good evening, everybody. Let's begin by setting our motivation. And again, feeling fortunate that another week has gone by and we haven't died. That's quite extraordinary, actually, when you think about how fragile our life is, how hard it is to keep ourselves alive, how much work we have to do to keep this body functioning. And yet we still have this precious human life, which is so meaningful, so rare to obtain. And so it's important to use it wisely, because at the time of our death, we can't rerun the life and live it over again. So we have to do the best we can at each moment. And even if we act negatively, or even if we make bad decisions, then we have to purify them and learn from them and make them somehow a condition into our progressing along the path. So instead of getting hung up in guilt or shame or regret, purify, learn, set a determination for the future and go on. And the best way to go on is with the thought wishing to benefit all living beings, seeing them as exactly like us and wanting to help them in the same way that we help ourselves. So the best way to help others is not simply by giving them the things they need in this life, but by helping them be free of all lives in cyclic existence altogether. And to do that most efficaciously, we need to free ourselves first and attain full enlightenment. And so it's with that long-term goal in mind that we listen to the teachings this evening. Text, Mind Training Like Rays of the Sun, we've covered the first point about the preliminaries, which were precious human life, death and impermanence, karma and its effects, and the disadvantages of cyclic existence. Okay? So we talked about those. And so now we're on the section of actually generating the bodhicitta. How many ways are there to generate the bodhicitta?
Two.
What's the name of the first one? Okay, this is the 7-point instruction of cause and effect. Yeah. And what's the preliminary to that one?
Equanimity.
And what are the 7? Seeing all beings as our parents or as our mother, remembering their kindness, wanting to repay it, heartwarming love, compassion, the great resolve, and bodhicitta. And which ones? It's 7 points of cause and effect. How many are causes? And what's the effect? Bodhicitta. Okay. Good. We're getting there. So have you thought about the kindness of your parents? Have you thought about all sentient beings as having been your parents? Okay, that one's very important. Because if you just think about the kindness of your parents, you're going to get attached to your parents. Yeah. So we don't need to meditate to create more attachment. Yeah. So that's why it was very important to do this equanimity meditation. So that we really, you know, open the mind. And remember that sentient beings are not who they appear to be. See, this is where we get so stuck, because the appearance of this life is so strong, and we think that who somebody is who they appear to be in this lifetime. So if somebody is our mother or our father or brother, sister, or our kitty or whatever they are, we think this is an inherently existent sentient being. You know, this is them. This is who they are. You know, and that there's some kind of essence from the side of the person that makes them that relationship to us. Okay? But there's nothing from the side of the person that makes them that relationship to us. Yeah. Because when you think about it, last lifetime was the person who's our mother this lifetime, our mother last lifetime. Highly unlikely, like nearly impossible. Okay? And the person who's our mother this lifetime could have been an enemy in a previous lifetime, could have been the garbage collector, could have been the president, could have been our pet goldfish. We don't know. Yeah? All these things are completely changing all the time. So the relationship we have with somebody in this life is just a temporary relationship of this life. There's nothing in that person that makes them that relationship to us. Now you might say, but we have the same blood, you know, we have the same genes. Well, what are genes? Yeah. They're arrangements of chemicals. Okay. This gong is an arrangement of chemicals. Yeah? Is there any inherent affiliation between me and this gong? Yeah. And it could be if you recycle some of the, it's probably not enough organic material in the gong, but, you know, in some poo. You recycle some poo, becomes food, somebody eats it, it becomes the body of the person you love. Recycle poo. It becomes the genes that you feel are so inherently linking you to that group, to that person. Yeah? I mean, genes are just a bunch of chemicals. My goodness. So what's such a big deal? We have the same similar genes as somebody else. If we both eat broccoli, do you feel so close to the other person who eats broccoli because you have the same thing inside your body that they have inside their body? You both have broccoli? No. We don't go around, you know, with our antenna out looking for all the other people for whom we share broccoli with. That we all have broccoli in our bodies, so therefore we are inherently connected. Okay? So when you think about it, this genetic thing is like, you know, huh? What are you talking about? Because anyway, are you your body? Yeah? Are you your body? Are you your genes? If you looked at a bunch of genes in a Petri dish, are you going to go, oh, that's my mother, or that's me? Yeah? You want to hug those genes in a Petri dish?
My Petri dish.
Yeah, You know, when you really look at what our attachment is based on and how we create attachment, it's really nutty. It's really nutty. And look at how many wars are fought based on feeling close to certain people because you have similar genes, and distant from other people because your genes aren't so similar. But when you really think about it, everybody's genes are made of, you know, oxygen and hydrogen and carbon and nitrogen and whatever else. So actually, they're all pretty similar. But look at how many wars and how many ethnic conflicts there are on this planet because of genes. Yeah, and because feeling that because we have the same genes, therefore I should cherish this one more than that one, and this one is my friend, and that one's my enemy. It's horrible, isn't it? You know, and how many people get murdered and killed just because of difference in genes? Yeah, it's so sad. So this thing of, you know, taking the appearance of a person in this life and feeling that that's who they are and that there's something in them, in their body and in your body, that makes you especially close to them, that's made up by the mind. Okay? It's made up by the mind. You know, for rearing children, it's a good thing to make up by the mind, you know, because some parents take care of the babies. But it's, you know, beyond that, it's really, it can be such a divisive thing. Such a divisive thing. Yeah. And anyway, you know, like I said, we take the appearance of the person this life and think that's who they are and that's what our relationship is. And then they die, and then they get reborn, and then they're in a different body. And then what? Yeah? Then what? Yeah. Because they just had the thing where they arrested the international court. They didn't arrest, but they want to charge the president of Sudan with... they didn't come to the conclusion of genocide, but with... war crimes and this kind of stuff. Okay, so I believe he's Arab, and then the people in Darfur are a different ethnic group. And even the people in Darfur, there's a bunch of different ethnic groups. Okay, so everybody's hanging on to their own ethnic identity. You feel, oh, my group, these are my friends, you know. So this guy, who's the president, who clearly has, you know, some bias with these other ethnic groups. Yeah. Let's say he dies and he gets born as a child in one of these other ethnic groups. Then what? Then what? Yeah? Yeah. I mean, it's just, he's, you know, when he gets born in one of the other tribal groups, then he develops that identity. Then he doesn't like the group that he belonged to in his previous life. And maybe he even hears stories about what that former president did to the people of his tribal group. And then he really dislikes that person who he used to be in his previous life. Yeah? And then all the people that he didn't like this life, next life he's born with them and they're his best friends. And he treats them favorably and has bias against the other ones. Crazy. Crazy, isn't it? Yeah. So this is what samsara is about. And you can see how it's all just made up by mind. Completely made up by mind. But then we don't realize we make it up, and we think it's real, and we think it's there from the side of the object. And besides, all of society believes like that and thinks like that. So how can I possibly think different than everybody else? I can't think different than everybody else. So we just buy into the current social conventions. That's how the Nazis got so popular. You know, you just buy into what's happening. That's how Stalin got so popular, you know, or Mao, or Bush.
Bush.
Things like that, you know. But we just buy into what's going on at the time and don't think for ourselves, you know. But then even all these people that I'm mentioning, you know, they too, they're going to die and come back in different lives. And we're going to have totally different relationships with them. You know? The person who was Mao maybe comes back as your child who you love tremendously. Yeah? So we don't know. All these things are changing all the time. So grasping onto some permanent relationship or permanent identity doesn't make much sense. It's like Kathleen was saying the other day, you know, how you realize that you just had the feeling that somewhere in your body there was a little room with you sitting inside. Yeah? And that's the way we feel, you know. Somewhere in there, there's a little room with the essence of me sitting inside. And then somewhere inside everybody else's body, if you opened it up, you know, you're not going to find blood and guts, but you're going to find, you know, some little room with the essence of the person in there. Okay. Yeah. A few of you are in the medical profession and have dissected corpses. Have you ever seen anything like that in any of your anatomy classes?
No.
It isn't there. Yeah. So there's no part of this body that we can identify as this is me. Yeah. It's amazing. And so, you know, feeling close to some people and distant to others based on the body is just our own made-up superstition. And then feeling so attached to this body to start with, that's also made up superstition, isn't it? Yeah, when you look at it. But boy, do we believe it. I am this body. This body is my most cherished thing. But it's just made up. You know, we mentally make up what our relationship with this body is. Now somebody's going to say, well, it's biologically built into us. We're hardwired like that. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, what do you mean we're hardwired like that? What do you point to as the hard wire? What's the hard wire that makes you like that? Habitual patterns, what are those? That's not scientific. You know, they talk about hardwire. It's part of our biology. It's part of our cellular makeup, they say. So, are you going to be able to open up a cell and find within that cell attachment to the body? You're going to be able to find the chemicals that are attachment to the body? Wouldn't that be nice if we could? Then we could just get rid of those chemicals. Have no attachment to the body. But then the people would say, oh, but you have to have attachment to the body. Otherwise, you won't want to stay alive. But the attachment to the body is so painful when your body's failing and you can't stay alive. Isn't it? Yeah. What about if we wanted to stay alive to benefit others, but not out of attachment to the body? That'd be something. You know. So when they say it's hardwired, well, what do you point to me? Point to me. Show me that thought of I am my body, or, you know, this is me. I've got to protect it at all costs. Yeah, very hard to show, isn't it? You know, in that paradigm, yeah, that only values kind of material. Okay. So when we start to really examine how we think and what common assumptions are, we see that so much is just made up by the mind. Totally fabricated by the mind. And then we believe it. Then we fight each other over it. Then we make ourselves unhappy over it. Yeah. It's really quite amazing when we start to look at it. Really, really amazing. And so sad. Okay. So, we're going to... I'm going to continue reading from the text, and then I hope to get to talk about the meditation of equalizing self and others this evening, because it'll pick up on what I just talked about, you know, some similar things. But to get there, first we have to read a little bit in the text. Okay? So we're on the section that says, exchanging yourself with others through acknowledging the faults of selfishness and the advantages of concern for others. Okay. Now we're thinking, acknowledging the faults of going out of my way to help others and the advantages of caring for myself? Yeah, that sounds good. Okay, so Nam Kai Pel says, the great pioneers, this is referring to Nagarjuna and Asanga, have explained that in general, cultivating the awakening mind involves the twofold activity of being concerned with the welfare of others and being concerned with enlightenment. Okay, remember that? So those are those two aspirations that go along with bodhicitta. With regard to the first, we should see those sentient beings who are the object of our concern as being equally pleasing and agreeable. The way to achieve this includes being led through the method of seven causes and one result. So we've already covered that. Having realized that relatives arouse feelings of pleasure, enemies arouse feelings of unease, and those who are neither give rise to feelings of indifference, meditate on all sentient beings as being close to you. Although in reality all sentient beings are not your mother, at least not in this lifetime, by meditating on recognizing them as your mother, remembering their kindness and wishing to repay it, generate a sense of their being attractive. Okay? So remember that, what was it? The three initial points were the basis for generating the aspiration to benefit others. So that's that. Okay? And then love and compassion were the attitudes wishing to benefit. And the two great resolves are the thoughts deciding to benefit. And the bodhicitta is the actual way to do it. According to the training that follows the exalted Chanti Devas tradition, once we have grasped the many disadvantages of a self-centered attitude, we will be inclined to give it up, and realizing the many benefits of appreciating others, we will generate a sense of sentient beings who are the object of our concern as being attractive, pleasing, and dear to us. Okay, so you'll see that both methods of generating bodhicitta, you want to find a way to find sentient beings to appear in a pleasing manner to you. Because it's difficult to have love and compassion unless the object of love and compassion appears pleasing to you. Okay, so the way you do that in the seven-point instruction is by meditating on others as having been our mother, our parents, and having been kind to us, and therefore they're pleasing to us. And here we do it by thinking of the disadvantages of being self-centered and the benefits of cherishing others. And that way, seeing sentient beings as pleasing and that having a kind heart to them is something that's beneficial. Okay, so that's how we do it. Since the great conqueror's son, Chekhova's technique for cultivating the awakening mind relies upon the latter of these two approaches. In other words, Shantideva's approach of equalizing, exchanging self for others. His explanation has two sections showing what is to be given up by contemplating the disadvantages of selfishness, that's the first section, and showing what is to be put into practice through contemplating the benefits of concern for others. Okay? So here we jump right into seeing the disadvantages of self-centeredness and the benefit of cherishing others. But actually, there's some things that come before that that I want to cover. And one of these things is the meditation of equalizing self and others. And so I learned this meditation as having 9 points. I've been trying to find out what the history of this was, and I don't know where it came from. I mean, I know that Senshin Serkan Rinpoche taught it to me, but I'm not sure, like, who in the lineage developed this 9-point equalizing meditation. But personally speaking, I find it very, very powerful, extremely powerful and helpful. Okay? And so there's 9 points. They're divided into three. Okay? The first three sets of three. Okay? The first two sets are looking at things from the conventional viewpoint. And the last set, it looks at things from the ultimate viewpoint. Okay? So the two sets that are looking at things from the conventional viewpoint. The first one is conventionally looking at it with 3 points from according to the viewpoint of others, and then the second set is looking at it conventionally according to the viewpoint of oneself, and then the third set is the reasoning that's based on the ultimate truth, looking at it from the ultimate viewpoint. Okay? So let's look at it. The first one, like a conventional viewpoint, but it's based on the viewpoint of others. In other words, who others are. Okay? So we have 3 points within this. The first one is everybody wants happiness and nobody wants suffering. The second one is an example of beggars, and that if you have 10 beggars, they all want happiness, so discriminating amongst them is unfair. And then the third point is the example of 10 patients in a hospital who all want to be free of suffering, and so discriminating against them is unfair. So let's go back to the first of these points, okay? So the first one is, and now we're looking at it, you see, from the viewpoint of others, who these other sentient beings are. The first point is that everybody wants happiness and nobody wants suffering. Yeah. And this is kind of bottom line, you know. It's like we all know this at some point, at least intellectually, but when it comes down to living our life like that, we really have short-term memory loss. Yeah? It's like, you know, when somebody does something we don't like, we forget they're trying to be happy and be free of suffering. That goes totally out the window. We never think of them as a sentient being who's just trying to be happy and find a way to not suffer. You know, it's so difficult to see them like that. Instead, we see them as manipulative, as psychotic, as pulling one over on us, as deceptive, as cheating, as lying, as, you know, flirting, as flattering, as, you know, all sorts of other things. But we don't see them as somebody who's just trying to be happy and be free of suffering and doing what they're doing because they think that'll bring that about. But that's really what the bottom line is. And we're all alike in that wish for happiness and that wish not to have suffering. And there's no difference amongst us in that way, is there? Yeah. And so the fact that, like, all day long we're thinking me, yeah, me, my happiness, my belongings, my relationships, my welfare, my health, my, you know, financial condition, my this, my that, you know, all the time thinking me, it's really unbalanced, isn't it? Because everybody else wants to be happy as strongly as we do. It's not that, you know, our wish to be happy is somehow at level 10 and everybody else's wish to be happy is at level 2. It's not like that. You know, we all want to be happy equally. Yeah. And we all want to be free of suffering equally. Every single one of us. Yeah. And it doesn't matter who you are. You know, whether you're this, I can't remember, Bashir, the president of Sudan, you know, that they just kind of did this thing with, you know, whether you're him or whether you're, it doesn't matter who, yeah. Even you're an animal or an insect or a hell being or a hungry ghost or a deva, it doesn't matter who you are. You just want to be happy and not have suffering. Yeah. So one really amazing thing is to watch the news and everybody that comes on there. You know, you see good people, you see what we call good people, you see what we call bad people. But instead of putting those names on them, you think a sentient being who wants to be happy and not suffer. Yeah. So excellent meditation. You know, when you're out in public, I do this a lot at airports. Yeah. Just looking around. Yeah. This person who fills up a seat and a half, and I get the other half of my seat. They're just trying to be happy and be free of suffering. That's it. You know? Yeah. Look at this kid that's crying is trying to be happy and be free of suffering. The parent that's yelling at the kid is trying to be happy and be free of suffering. Yeah, the bug in my room, the spider in my room. Be happy and be free of suffering. All these turkeys out there. Did you know that turkeys like chocolate cake? I had a little experiment today. They like chocolate cake. They'll also settle for cracked corn. They might actually prefer it. But, okay. You know, but just cultivating that habit of everybody you look at wants to be happy and wants to be free of suffering equally. Okay? So it's not just that people who are suffering right now want to be free of suffering, but it's the people who look well and happy and rich and have everything, they also want to be free of suffering. Okay? So, well, really spread it out. And it's quite strong when you practice this a lot. Then it's like whenever you look at somebody, you know something very, very deep and intimate and important about them, which is they want to be happy and not suffer. And that means, and when you know that about somebody, you can connect with them on that level. So it doesn't matter what they look like or what they're doing. You can look into their heart and connect with them on that level of they want to be happy and be free of suffering. That's very, very powerful. Now the second point is, why do we discriminate amongst all sentient beings if they all want to be happy? Why do we favor some sentient beings and not others? Why do we favor ourselves and put others second, if we all want to be happy and nobody wants to suffer. Yeah. And so the example is given is if you have 10 beggars in the street. Now, of course, if you've lived in India, you confront this on a daily basis, you know, but maybe you go downtown and there's a lot of homeless people, or you work in a shelter or whatever. And everybody needs something. Yeah. So what is the justification for favoring one person who's in need and not favoring another one who's in need? Okay. They may need different things. One person needs a sweater, another person needs a pair of pants, another person wants an energy bar. Okay. They all need something. They all want something. So they're all equal in wanting happiness. Okay. So why in our mind do we favor one over the other? Okay. Now it's important to understand this correctly, because otherwise you're going to go downtown and there's somebody who needs a sweater and somebody who needs a bottle of booze, and you're going to say, why am I favoring the person who needs a sweater and not the one who needs a bottle of booze? And so I think I'll go get him a bottle of booze. Bad decision. Okay? We're not talking about how we're acting towards people here, because clearly we have to act according to the situation and do what's best for somebody. But what we're talking about is mentally, why do we think one person's happiness is more important? And why do we favor one over the other? Okay, even though there's different things that bring them happiness. Okay? And then the third point is when we look at different beings who are suffering, again, why do we favor some over others? Why do we think, for example, that our relative's suffering is more painful than the suffering of our enemy? Or that our own suffering is more painful than our relative's suffering? Why? You know, and the example here is you have 10 patients in a hospital and they all are suffering from different diseases, but they all need medicine. So why help one and ignore the other? So here we're talking about on a mental level, why favor one and ignore the other when everybody needs medicine, even though they need different medicine? And what is medicine for one person is going to make another person sicker. Okay, so what we're trying to do here is smooth out the playing ground. So we're not just smoothing it out between friends, enemies, and strangers, but also between ourselves and others. Yeah. So when this thought comes of me, you know, my happiness, what I want, what's convenient for me, to be able to say, well, wait a minute, you know, other people want what's convenient for them. Other people want what makes them happy. And it's not that my wish is any more important than theirs. And it's not that, you know, the people who are near and dear to me are more important in the big picture than the people who aren't. Because anyway, we all change. Okay? So you will act differently according to different people. But on a mental level, you know, the mind has the same kind of openness and feeling of closeness and receptivity to others. And sometimes that's the thing, actually, that more than anything else can really make somebody feel good. Yeah? Is showing that human respect to them. Whether you give them something or don't give them something, showing that human respect is something that actually often makes somebody feel better than the physical thing. Mm-hmm. Okay, then the second set, we're still dealing on the conventional level, but here it's looking at it from the viewpoint of ourselves. Okay, so here we're talking kind of about our reactions and how we are. And so The first point here, well, I'll just list the 3 points. The first one is that all sentient beings have been kind to us, so we should help everybody. Second point is if you think that they've harmed you, remember that the help that you've received from them is greater. And third point is that since we're going to die, there's no sense in holding grudges or discriminations. Okay? So whether people feed you or don't feed you, he doesn't believe me. He favors Venerable Samke. The kitty. The people on the internet don't know who I'm talking about. Okay, so the first point here is that everybody has benefited us, and so we should, you know, benefit in return. So this is a very, very powerful meditation, and this one I think we should really spend a long time doing. Yeah, so just like the one of everybody wants happiness and nobody wants suffering, this one of everybody's benefited me, so I should, you know, return the benefit to everybody, is very, very important. And so here we start looking around us at everything we have and everything we know and everything we're able to do and see how many other living beings we are dependent upon to be able to do and have and be what we do and have and are. Okay? And that we're not these independent entities that pick ourselves up by our own bootstrap and can make everything go well for ourselves. But rather, you know, our good conditions come about due to the kindness of others. You know, but to really think about that, and just think, you know, okay, we're here now having teachings. How many sentient beings were involved in our having the ability to have these teachings tonight? Well, first of all, we have to look back in each of our own individual lives and how many sentient beings have benefited us, you know, from our parents and our teachers and the farmers who grew the food and the people who packed it and distributed it and cooked it and all that, and the people who taught us to read and write and everything there. Yeah. And then how many people were involved in constructing this building and planning and plumbing and, you know, electricity and all those kinds of things and installing the carpet and, you know, and how many people were involved in having the telephone and having the video camera, you know, inventing these things and marketing them and distributing them and selling them and repairing them and so on. How many people, you know, were involved in us having this book? Yeah? And, I mean, when you look, it just goes on and on and on and on and on. And, you know, our lives are so intertwined. And I think more so now than at any other time in human history, we are dependent on others. You know, even though in Western culture we have this big individualistic streak that's kind of come up in the last 100 or 200 years, it's ironic that that's come about with the Industrial Revolution, when the Industrial Revolution has made us more dependent on others, not less dependent. Isn't that strange? That we feel more independent because I can have my own stuff and lock myself in my own room, you know? But actually, all the stuff we have comes from others. We're more dependent on them than ever before. And so in that way, really to see the kindness of other living beings. And, you know, the kindness of so many strangers who do all these different jobs in society that keep us alive. Yeah, so really thinking about that. And I remember when Lama Zopa once was teaching about this, and he was talking about being up in Laodo. That's where his previous life meditated. And so these, some of the Sherpa people who live in the Lado area would come and see him. And this was, you know, maybe 30 years ago. The people were very, very poor there. I think they're still poor, but they do have cell phones up there now. Yep. But anyway, they didn't have cell phones there at the time. But and the people were very poor. And he said that sometimes people would come to him and, you know, because he's a recognized incarnate, they would want to make offerings to him, you know, to create merit. And they would give him like 1 rupee. Yeah. And he just felt like their kindness is so much just in all the different ways that he's benefited from these people's kindness throughout all of his different lifetimes. And he felt like, how can I possibly take 1 rupee from them? They've given me so much and they're so poor. How can I accept 1 rupee? And I remember him talking about this, you know. Clearly you can see it made an impression on me. Yeah. And so, you know, really that feeling of being interwoven with others. And that we've received so much that instead of wanting to take, wanting to give. Then the second point is, as we're thinking about the kindness of others, one corner of our mind says, yes, but, famous last words, yes, but they've also harmed me. Okay, they've been kind, but they've also harmed me. And then we pull out our computer file. The one that never gets corrupted, that never gets accidentally erased. The computer file of the list of every single thing anybody's ever done that's hurt my feelings or harmed me. You know, we have that list well intact. You know, and especially if you live with somebody, if you're in a domestic relationship, a partner relationship, you really keep that one very close. Because the next time you get in a fight, you need some of that data as ammunition. Yeah. When they start accusing you and saying, you know, you did this to me and you did this and you did this, well, you just open up your file and then there it is at your fingertips. Well, you did this and you did this and you did this. You know. So, so we do that, don't we? To what a positive function? To what avail? To what goodness? What benefit does it bring about? None. But we remember all the grudges, don't we? Yeah, we hold them very dear. And like I was saying earlier today, you know, we make that the identity of the person. That's who they are. It's that person that's treated me like this. How dare they? Okay. So you remember, you know, that in actual fact, if we compare the amount of harm we've received from somebody from the amount of benefit, the benefit we've received far outweighs the harm. Yeah. Now the thing is, you may say, well, I don't know about that, you know. This person, you know, maliciously did something to destroy my reputation. How can you say that they've done more good than harm? Well, again, if we look in the big picture and how they play their role in society and how we indirectly receive benefit from them, and if we think of, you know, the relationships we've had with them in previous lives, then we really see we have received a lot of benefit from them. And in comparison, the amount of harm we've received is quite small. And so especially on the days when we're feeling pity parties, you know, what's that one? Nobody likes me, everybody hates me, think I'll eat some worms. Yeah, I'll eat some worms. I remember that one? Yeah? And you didn't learn that? Oh, you're uneducated. You're what?
Younger.
Oh, yeah. Did you know that one, Chanfo? Oh. You've lived here longer than he has. Okay. So, you know, when we get into those moods of feeling sorry for ourselves, then to remember, actually, we've received much more harm. Much more harm.
That's what we're remembering.
Then we remember that actually we received much more benefit than harm, you know, from others. Yeah. And when we remember that, then we put our can of worms down and, you know, decide to get on with our life. Okay. Yeah. So it's very helpful. Like that, you know, when we think about karma and when we receive some insult and then we think it's the result of, you know, my having insulted others, and then we think which has been more, the number of times I've insulted others or the number of insults I've received. Number of insults that we've received, right? They did it more. No, it's the number of insults that we've given, isn't it? Yeah. When we think about how harshly we've spoken to others, how many times repeatedly have we received that kind of treatment in return? Take a little tab. Do you think you go through one day without criticizing somebody? Think about it. Even when we're trying to keep silence in retreat, you know, we wind up saying something. And even if we're not saying it, the mind's saying it, isn't it? But how many bad things do you hear about yourself from other people every day? Yeah. But if we really look at it, you know, we've dished out much more than we've received. And so the same thing here, you know, others have benefited us much more than they've harmed us. You had a question?
Yes, you talk about the benefits more than harms, then it would be possible karma to create a kind of life and
okay, so if sentient beings benefited us more than they harmed us, wouldn't they be creating a lot more positive karma than negative karma? It depends on their mind states when they benefit us, and it depends on the strength of, you know, the motivation and on when they do positive actions and when they do negative actions. And the thing is here, too, and this comes up sometimes, is when we think of others benefiting us, they don't necessarily have to have the intention to benefit us. We're just looking at the benefit we receive. So others may benefit us without having the intention to, so they may not create so much good karma because of the lack of the motivation, but in terms of our having received kindness, we've received a lot. Okay. And then the third point in this is that so if you're still hanging on to some anger after all of this, mm-hmm. after, you know, that thinking of their kindness and the mind goes yes, but, and then thinking that they've helped you more than they've harmed you and your mind still goes yes, but, okay, then you think, I'm going to die. And they're going to die. And of what benefit is holding a grudge in this life if we're both going to die? Yeah. And again, I find that very, very powerful, you know. Because when you think about it, do you want to die with anger and grudge and vengeance on your mind against some other sentient being? Is that the way you want to leave this life? If we don't want to leave this life then, when we die, why are we cultivating that now? Yeah? Somebody harmed us? So what? We don't need to build a big identity over it and treasure that identity of I'm the victim of somebody else's harm. Because what good does it do us to make ourselves into a victim? Yeah? Because we think victim is what somebody else makes us. We make ourselves into a victim by how we think. We make ourselves into the victim by how we think. So if we stop making ourselves into a victim and stop holding grudges, our mind is so much freer and so much happier right now. And then we can do so much more with our lives. Whereas if we hold on this grudge, you know, as if it's some precious jewel that we can't lose, then, I mean, that just tortures us, doesn't it? Yeah. That's why I want to say, I always say, if you want to make yourself miserable, hold a grudge. It's the best way to make yourself miserable. Yeah? Because it is. Because as we sit there and stew in our resentment and our anger and our hatred and our jealousy and our envy and how come they got this and I didn't and all this kind of stuff, it's thoughts in our mind that make us 102% miserable and produce no benefit for anybody. And in addition, all these sentient beings have been kind to us and we're going to die. And do we want to die with this kind of grudge? I had a woman come to me one time for counseling. She was in her 70s. And she told me this whole story, which I won't tell you, about what her husband did and how it affected her and everything. But her conclusion was, I don't want to die with that hate in my mind, and I don't want to die with my hate. I don't want him to die with my hatred on him. Yeah, and she said, help me get rid of this. So we talked. But I thought that was such a beautiful thing from her own mind of just seeing, you know, I don't want to die with this. Yeah, and if you don't want to die with it, why live with it? Why live with something that is making you miserable? And I'm talking internally in our own minds. Why live with those thoughts that make us miserable when we have the option of letting them go? Yeah? Okay. So I only got through 6 of the points. We'll have to save the other 3 for next week. But I find these points very, very rich for meditation. Very, very rich. And very rich for making examples from our own life and really reflecting on these examples in our own life. And if we do, it definitely changes our outlook. Quite definitely. Okay.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances, grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable stable, and their divine action spread in the ten directions. May the light of Losung's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Iranguru Ratna Mandala Kamiryatayami. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the enlightened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May the born of no decline but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain paradise, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful tending gets such a mercy. May you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders who spread the view of dependent arising and non-violent actions in the ten directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West Glory.